Afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I am Andrew Lowe, counsel for the appellant, Bachelor Gulch Metropolitan District. The plaintiffs in this case are not entitled to an award of attorney's fees because one plaintiff asserted its claim for fees, asserted its Section 1983 claim far too late, and neither plaintiff asserted a Section 1983 claim that passed the Supreme Court's substantiality test. Let's start with Beaver Creek's failure to assert a timely Section 1983 claim.
I just want to counsel have themselves. Side.
Yes, I'm arguing. I'm the only person arguing on my side, so yes. I understand. I'd like to start with Beaver Creek and its failure to assert a timely Section 1983 claim. Beaver Creek relies on an absolutely unprecedented theory for its award of attorney's fees. It contends that it may assert only state law claims, litigate those claims clean through, move for summary judgment, win partial summary judgment on one state law claim, and then when it has done so, amend its complaint and add Section 1983 claims for the first time, and then recover attorney's fees retroactive to the beginning of the case. When a governmental defendant is sued, it needs to have the information with which to decide whether to defend or settle. And Sections 1983 and 1988 do not contemplate that a governmental defendant can be ambushed in this manner. A governmental defendant needs to know when it decides whether to defend a case, whether its potential future liability might include the plaintiff's attorney's fees. Section 1988 was created for the purpose of allowing plaintiffs to vindicate their constitutional and other federal rights by getting awards of attorney's fees. It was not intended as a mousetrap or ambush to trap unwilling governmental defendants who never realized that they might have to pay attorney's fees to at least one of the plaintiffs in this case, and then only afterward we're told, oh, by the way, we'd like our attorney's fees.
And your argument here, Mr. Lowe, is that Beaver Creek not only didn't make any kind of substantial constitutional claim, and I understand there's a dispute about that with respect to Strawberry Park, there was no claim at all, a constitutional claim at all.
Yes, the failure to assert the timely claim applies only to Beaver Creek. The failure to assert a substantial claim applies to both plaintiffs. But as the amicus brief really very aptly put it, their theory is like letting gamblers bet on a horse race after the race has been run. They rely on two points of law. Both of them are without merit. This is Beaver Creek now. First, they argue that the two federal courts of appeal cases in Solomon and Americans United are on point, they say, and authorize exactly what happened here, an award of attorney's fees under these circumstances. That is not correct. If you look at those cases, you will see that in both cases, the constitutional claim was asserted at the very beginning of the case. The only thing that those cases tell us is that it is not fatal to a claim for attorney's fees, that the plaintiff did not label that claim as being brought under 1983. And that certainly does not authorize an award of fees for Beaver Creek here. The second legal argument that Beaver Creek makes is the doctrine of relation back. They say, yes, I know we asserted our constitutional claims very late, but under Rule 15C, they relate back to the beginning of the case. But as we've said in the briefs, that doctrine was created and exists for purposes of the statute of limitations. It has never been applied in a context like this to allow attorney's fees from the beginning of the case for a 1983 claim asserted essentially after the plaintiff had won on liability.
Has it ever been applied in a post?
Essentially what happened here, isn't it?
No, it was pre-judgment, but it was post-entry of summary judgment on liability on a state law claim. What was left was simply the entry of the injunction, which was the relief. And, of course, the 1983 claims were undecided, and there was a pending trial of a claim by Bachelor Gulch against Vail, which ultimately later went to trial. So there were a number of pieces of the case still outstanding. So the relation back doctrine then really was created for statute of limitations purposes. Getting a little dry. In a last-minute Rule 28J letter, our adversary, Beaver Creek, has brought to the court's attention a 1985 decision of this court in Wilson, the Wilson case, Wilson versus Goldman. And that case they submit is on point. Again, it is not. In that case, first of all, it's not a 1983 case at all. It's purely state law. Second of all, and I think probably more importantly, in that case, the claim for which fees were sought was asserted at the beginning of the case. It was a claim for breach of a real estate covenant, and that was in there at the beginning of the case. The only thing that changed in midstream, in the middle of the case, was that the plaintiffs had gotten confused as to which party was the right one to assert the claim as a kind of a technical matter for attorney's fees, and they corrected that in midstream. That, again, is not our situation. The defendant was on notice that there was this claim for breach of the covenant right from the very beginning, and it was asserted by the claims, by the parties that sought attorney's fees. So what we found then is that there are no cases on point, directly, squarely on point here. This court is free to interpret the law as it sees fit, and I submit to the court that there is no reason to interpret Section 1988 to make possible this kind of ambush tactics by Beaver Creek. And I don't accuse them of bad faith. They may not have intended to do it that way, but that was the effect of the way that it worked out. So that's the Beaver Creek point and the timeliness point. I'd like to turn now to the substantiality test, which applies to the claims brought by both plaintiffs. And here, of course, we know that under the U.S. Supreme Court precedents, that if a plaintiff brings both state law claims and 1983 claims, and then prevails one way or another on only the state law claims, then the plaintiff is entitled to attorney's fees so long as the 1983 claims were substantial. And substantiality has been defined to mean a number of different things, but we also know from the Supreme Court cases that a claim is not substantial if it is obviously without merit. And that's right out of the Supreme Court decisions in Higgins versus Levine, for example. And in this case, we can see on the face of both plaintiffs' pleadings that their claims are obviously without merit and therefore not substantial. Why is that? Because they're equal protection and substantive due process claims. And as the plaintiffs acknowledge, the regulation at issue will be upheld against a constitutional challenge if there's if any conceivable set of facts would produce a rational basis for the regulation, for the classification in the regulation, that is, for distinguishing between the two classes of traffic. And here, it was as clear as the nose on my face right from the pleading of Strawberry Park. Strawberry Park, after describing the whole situation, attached to the back of its complaint a map which showed the two routes, and it showed that the route through Bachelor Gulch was longer and had many sharp turns, whereas the route through Beaver Creek was shorter and straighter.
Mr. Lowe, if I can interrupt you here, I want to backtrack a little bit and catch up to you. And I'll let you get a drink of water. You make actually, it was an interesting argument I found in your briefs about the substantiality test at all. Does it even apply in a state court since it came out of a jurisdictional, pendant jurisdiction question? I think you would agree. The legislative history under Section 1988 indicates Congress was intending to adopt the Higgins substantiality test. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
So far? All right. So if assuming that Higgins test applies, and Strawberry Park argues vehemently, that if it states a claim that survives 12b-5 or 12b-6 in federal court, it would necessarily pass that essentially frivolous test. And I guess my question to you is, why wouldn't that be true? I know the Domney case, which has been cited in the briefs, basically says that. Of course it's true if it passes that, if it states a claim, it's going to survive that test. So tell me why that isn't true, and then related to that, if we go your way, do we have to disagree with the Brown and Dayton opinions of divisions of this court?
No, I think all the law is consistent. We agree that the Higgins decision sets the standard. I think Brown and Dayton, although they omitted the word obviously, I think they must be read as adopting exactly the same standard. I did not mean to imply that there was a different standard. In my briefs, I always said either without merit under Brown or Dayton, or obviously without merit under Higgins. I think it's the same thing. And indeed, we're bound. On a federal claim, we're bound by decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's no dispute there. Before I get to the answer about 12b-5, I'd like to just mention that we are not relying on the frivolousness prong of the test, because it's, you know, there are multiple prongs, different ways that you can show that a claim is not substantial. Frivolous is one. We're not relying on that. We are relying on obviously without merit.
What's the difference between those two standards?
A good question. There is a very large body of case law, federal and U.S. Supreme Court case law, about what constitutes frivolousness in the context of prisoner petitions. We did not mean to be invoking that body of case law. You know, perhaps for frivolous, one can imagine these cases where pro se plaintiffs allege that their federal rights have been taken by aliens who, on behalf of the government, who planted chips in their brain. You know, those are clearly frivolous. And maybe they would be unsubstantial, too, but here we are relying on obviously without merit because it is so obvious. And let me now answer Judge Gabriel's question.
So, and there is a difference, but frivolous is kept to a unique set of cases, but obviously without merit is not?
There is much less case law construing obviously without merit. The reason that we chose that standard and are applying it is that it uses the word merit. And that, to me, says that it is asking us all to look at the face of the plaintiff's complaint and to determine whether we can see on the face of the complaint that there is no possible way that they could. It's not frivolous. I mean, you look at it, it all makes sense. You know, I mean, I acknowledged in my brief that since for purposes of 12b-5, we have to assume that the allegations are true, including the allegation that there's no rational basis. If you assume that that's true, but on substantiality analysis, we can take one look at the complaint and we can say, I don't have to assume that anymore because I'm not now confined by the Rule 12b-5 standard. Under substantiality, I can look at the merits on the face of the complaint and ask, is there any way that this plaintiff could prevail? And the answer is obviously not.
I'm having trouble, I guess, Mr. Law, understanding how that's different from the 12b-5 standards, which we still have in Colorado. We haven't followed the federal rule, which is the old Conley standard, which is, I mean, I guess maybe you're saying you don't assume the truth of the allegation, and maybe that's the distinction. But what if we're only looking at the face of the complaint, but we don't have to assume it's true, what else are we looking at? How do we decide it's not true?
Because of the uniqueness of the rational basis standard. For rational basis, they would have to prove their case factually beyond a reasonable doubt. But in defense of the constitutionality of a statute, if a judge can simply imagine a conceivable set of facts that produces a rational basis, that's enough under the Beach versus FCC Supreme Court case, under Colorado's law as well. And here, we don't have to imagine. It's right there on the face of their complaint. That map that they took, that they attached to the back of their complaint, that was taken out of our traffic engineering consultant's report, which concluded that the Beaver Creek route is safer. Exactly our point. And we don't have to prove that fact. That's not the issue. The issue is, can we conceive that there is a difference between these two classes and therefore a reason to treat them differently? Is there a rational reason? Heck yes. Yeah, you look at these two routes, you say, well, of course it's rational to think that heavy construction vehicles would be less safe going on a longer route with 17 or 19 hairpin turns than over a shorter, straighter route. I'm very short of time, and I'd love to keep the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Timothy Rostello. My Colorado Supreme Court registration number is 11511. Counsel for Beaver Creek, I represent Strawberry Park Owners Association. Counsel for Beaver Creek Property Owners Association, Mr. William Short, and I have agreed to split our 15 minutes, whereby I will take the first 10 minutes to address the legal standards, and Mr. Short will take the remaining 5 minutes to address the pleading issues.
Mr. Stoll, I don't want to interrupt you before you start. If I can tell the bailiff, the clock up here is not working. I see the clock back there ticking down, but we say show 15 minutes up here. There you go. Wait till you're there. You go.
Okay.
Thank you.
10 minutes.
The show's 10.
Yeah. They didn't want you to talk very long, apparently.
That was fine with me.
I'm sorry, Mr. Estella.
All right. This is at least the third time this court has been asked to address whether attorney fees may be awarded under 42 U.S.C. 1988, where a party has prevailed on a state law claim that arises out of a common nucleus of operative facts to a pending but unaddressed constitutional claim. As in the prior two cases, the answer is yes. Indeed, the answer is mandated by the Supreme Court's rulings in Mayer and Higgins. In Mayer, the Supreme Court found that a successful state law claim is sufficient to award fees under 1988, where the constitutional claim is not insubstantial and arises out of a common nucleus of operative facts to a successful state law claim. Here, the district does not appeal the fact that the two claims arise from the same operative facts. After a multiple-day preliminary injunction hearing in which Judge Gamet took hours of testimony and reviewed dozens of exhibits, and after extensive briefing on the state law claims, the trial court found, based on the facts in the record, that the homeowners' constitutional claims were not insubstantial. The term not insubstantial has been defined by the Hagen courts. These terms have been used interchangeably by the Supreme Court in Higgins. Essentially fictitious, wholly insubstantial, obviously frivolous, or obviously without merit. They're used interchangeably, and I have found no distinction between them. The Higgins court explained that a constitutional claim is insubstantial only if the unsoundness so clearly results from the previous decisions of the Supreme Court as to foreclose the subject and to leave no room for controversy. The district has not cited a single case, much less a U.S. Supreme Court case, that indisputably forecloses the homeowner's constitutional claims as frivolous or without merit. That should end this inquiry.
Can I ask you, Mr. Estella, I understand your argument that the words are used interchangeably. Has any? I guess I haven't seen a case that specifically said that. I've seen the litany of those words get listed. Is there a case that says they're interchangeable? And I guess I would appreciate your responding. Mr. Lowe makes an argument that they don't mean the same thing. They're different words. And so I'd be interested in your response to that.
Well, I would say reference to the Higgins case at page 537, at least in that context, Judge Gabriel, it appears that the court is using them interchangeably. And then in the Best v. Kelly case, a D.C. Circuit Court case, that court used interchangeably to describe constitutional insubstantiality as fantastic factual allegations, delusional or wholly incredible. A division of this court correctly recognized the principle in Brown when it stated, all that is required is a finding that the claim is not wholly frivolous and does not conflict with any United States Supreme Court decision.
Well, let me ask you, how close do those United States Supreme Court decisions have to be on point? Because they cite a number of cases saying rational basis test isn't very difficult to surmount. And on the face of it, you could conceive of reasons why there would be a rational basis for their action.
Well, the Supreme Court set a very low threshold for determining whether or not fees should be awarded under the Mayer test. For two important policy reasons. One was to further the judicial policy of avoiding addressing constitutional issues whenever possible. And second, to further Congress's stated policy of encouraging civil rights suits to vindicate violations of constitutional rights. More specifically,
Let me ask, aren't we putting form over substance here if we say that an equal protection claim here would be substantial when there is or appears to be a basic safety response that would satisfy a rational basis test?
Well, just the fact that we're having that argument now and that we had that discussion at the district court, is meets the mayor's standard because we are having that discussion, and that shows that it's not indisputable according to the Supreme Court precedent. We hotly disputed the existence of the rational basis. We believe it was pretextual, and let me tell you why. First of all, the regulation barred all traffic, not just construction traffic as asserted by the district. That meant Priuses and VWs were precluded, that were destined for Strawberry Park, were prohibited from using those roads. There is no conceivable rational basis for barring all such traffic. In addition, the district's own safety expert testified that safety was not an issue, that there had been no major incidents on the district's road for construction traffic destined for Strawberry Park during the prior 15 years, when 85% of the development had been built out. So the rational basis was hotly contested, greatly exceeds any frivolous standard, and is something that frankly, I think we would have prevailed on had we to go all the way, but we don't, because the Supreme Court has taught us that we are not to do that because it does not want to unnecessarily decide important constitutional issues.
Mr. Rosello, can I ask you, do you look at just the face of the complaint? Do you look at the fact it was hotly contested, or, you know, where are we looking? To make the decision if it's substantial.
Well, in my view, the Hagen's inquiry can go beyond the complaint. Okay. And in this case, Judge Gannett did go beyond the complaint, and in his order, he says, based on the facts in the record, I find that these constitutional claims were not insubstantial. And even if the regulation were limited to construction traffic, it's not rational to allow construction traffic destined to the furthest points in the district, but to prohibit the same type of construction traffic to points destined to Strawberry Park. As I said, at the time the regulation was enacted, most of Strawberry Park was built out. The regulation and the creation of an imposter police force that had no jurisdiction, no right to be out there, and that was dressed and outfitted in uniforms that were strikingly similar to the local police force, crossed constitutional boundaries. If anything, the complaint on its face establishes a constitutional violation in contrast to establishing the lack of one. The homeowners plainly satisfy the standard the Supreme Court articulated in Hagen's and Mayer. The trial court, as I said, found that based on the facts in the record, 500 pages of testimony, 124 exhibits, that the homeowners' constitutional claims were not wholly without merit and were not barred by existing Supreme Court precedent. Nothing more is required. The Supreme Court set down the Mayer and Hagen standards for Section 1988 fee awards. And under the Supremacy Clause, state courts are bound by those rulings and may not create a different standard even where our local government entities believe it would be good public policy. The trial court's judgment should be affirmed. Thank you if there are no further questions.
Good afternoon. My name is William H. Short. It's my privilege to represent the Beaver Creek property owners. As Mr. Rostello said, I'm confining my comments, unless there's some other questions, to the issue on the amendment of the pleadings. I think it is important to remember that the procedural history, as set forth in our brief at pages approximately 3 to 6, is not as simple as Mr. Lowe would have you believe. All that had occurred at the time that Beaver Creek moved to amend its claims to add constitutional claims was that the district court had entered partial summary judgment with respect to a claim for declaratory relief concerning the enforcement of the regulation.
And the declaratory relief was that it was unenforceable.
That it was.
And illegal.
That's correct.
Isn't that the whole basis for the claim in this case? This case was over when that happened.
I respectfully disagree, Judge Gabriel.
Okay.
For several reasons.
Please.
First of all, the court ruled on one of several claims. It ruled on the legal claim for declaratory relief. It had not yet ruled on a pending claim in the lawsuit for injunctive relief.
And when the court issued the injunction, didn't it say, I've already ruled on this, and based on my prior ruling, the injunction issues? There were no new findings the court made.
Actually, there were, respectfully.
Okay, please, please correct me.
And continuing with the fact pattern is, at the time that the partial summary judgment entered for declaratory relief, the parties had hoped that the lawsuit would end. And indeed, the record shows there were settlement efforts, which is what caused the delay, which then, when the court issued an order to show cause for the case not moving along, both Beaver Creek and the Metro District moved to amend their claims. And importantly here, the district had moved to add a claim that certain parts of the regulation were still valid for renovation or remodeling traffic. And Judge Gabriel, back to your question, yes, there were additional findings at the time that the injunction entered because the court had to go through the Rathke versus McFarland factors. It had to find there was irreparable harm. It had to find that the public service was fulfilled by the entry of an injunction. The case had not been effectively won, both for the at the time of the summary judgment, both for the reason that there had only been the declaratory relief, there hadn't been an injunction, and additional claims were asserted by the district.
Sure, but your constitutional claims were seeking an order that this regulation was unenforceable. That's the gist of what your constitutional claims were. You cannot enforce this regulation because it's unconstitutional. Well, that's what you're arguing, right?
The claims had been there from the beginning, that it was invalid. And the core, the key of Mr. Lowe's argument about why these claims should not be allowed is essentially a notice argument. And that fails for many reasons, Judge Gabriel, and if I may be allowed to continue, it does speak to what you're addressing, which seems to be there's some sort of lack of notice or they're not aware. First, both Strawberry Park and Vail had already asserted constitutional claims. Second, but long before final judgment entered, Beaver Creek successfully moved to amend its claims to assert constitutional claims. Third, in the Dayton case from a division of this court, the constitutional claims had been dismissed in a prior appeal, and yet, under the doctrine from Mayer, there is entitlement to fees because of the strong public policy reasons enunciated by Congress to allow for an award of attorney's fees. In the Solomon case, which is one of the cases that Judge Gannett relied upon, the constitutional claims had been specifically waived, yet, upon motion later on, there was entitlement to fees. And so the point is not necessarily, well, and finally, with respect to the relation back doctrine in Colorado, Wilson versus Goldman is on point because it speaks to the fact that attorney's fees are recoverable from the beginning of the claim. No, Wilson versus Goldman did not involve a constitutional claim. Yes, Mr. Grant.
Your judgment. I understood, Mr. Should him to say that problem here is. Exclusively for.
And that is precisely what Mr. Lowe argued, Judge Graham, and that is precisely why, in our notice of supplemental authority, we provided to you Wilson versus Goldman, which directly contradicts that assertion. Wilson versus Goldman directly holds that the relation back doctrine applies not just for statute of limitation purposes, but for purposes of a later arising amendment to allow for a claim for attorney's fees. And that is why Wilson versus Goldman is a very important case in your analysis here.
How do you distinguish the divisions of this court's decision in Brascia, if I'm pronouncing that correctly? That one involved a lease pendants, I think, where there was an attempt to have the claim relate back to save it and avoid lease pendants. And the division said relation back only applies to the statute of limitations.
I'm not familiar with the Brascia case holding on, but it, as applicable here, we're talking about a claim for attorney's fees, and that's an equitable claim, and whether or not relation back would apply there. But we have to go back to look at the important congressional intent and the doctrine announced by the Supreme Court in so many decisions going back 20 years as to why attorney's fees are allowed, for all the public policy reasons that where the courts avoid a constitutional issue, it would be unfair to deny the litigant relief that's only available under a constitutional statute. On the same day that the Mayer case was announced, there was the Maine versus, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, Thibodeau case, which is noted in the Brown case from a division of this court in 2006. And there, in a dissent, Judge Powell said an ingenious pleader could come up with claims later on. And that was a dissent that has never been accepted to thereby be entitled to an award of attorney's fees. Contrary to what's set forth in the amicus brief, contrary to what's set forth in Mr. Lowe's arguments, there's absolutely no empirical evidence that claims by that claims that have been amended later on are being used in a mischievous and improper way. There is zero empirical evidence. And Judge Powell's dissent in that Thibodeau case, announced on the same day as Mayer, has never been adopted as the law of the land. And the reason is that it is very important to keep this low substantiality standard to allow successful litigants to recover fees. Under relation back doctrine, the notice that the district already had, and the fact that they asserted new claims at the same time that Beaver Creek asserted claims, there is absolutely no reason to deny attorney's fees to Beaver Creek in this situation. We ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you for your time, unless there's another question.
May I ask one question? The entities here have standing to raise constitutional issues?
Which entities?
Your entities.
All. Well, I only represent Beaver Creek.
And tell me about Beaver Creek.
Okay. Beaver Creek does have standing because in addition to the equal process claim, they asserted a due process claim. And they had rights that they had arising from those recorded instruments.
Say they have rights. Who are they?
I represent a group of property owners that its interests are articulated by a property owners association, which is a corporation. Forgive the regal we. The PLA is entitled to enforce property rights guaranteed to its constituent members arising from the recorded plats and conveyances for which there were significant due process violations arising from this phantom police force. Thank you for your time. Thank you for letting me go over.
Please put a minute in addition on the clock for Mr. Lowe.
Not very scientific measurement of time, but it's close enough.
It's rough and ready. In my very short rebuttal, I'd like to make just a couple of quick points. First, going back to the Rule 12b-5 issue raised by Judge Gabriel before, I would like to refer the court back to our discussion of the Supreme Court's decision in Nitzke, where the Supreme Court indicated quite clearly that that a claim can be insubstantial even though it passes the 12b-6 on federal side failure to state a claim test. I won't go any further on that. Second, there was a lot of talk by Mr. Restello about his objections to the regulation. He talked about uniforms and so on and so forth. The only issue with respect to constitutionality is whether a rational person could have a basis for distinguishing between two classes of traffic. That's all. It doesn't matter whether it was a good idea. It doesn't matter whether there had been accidents or there had not. It's just a question of, could a rational person look at these two routes and say, yeah, one is safer? That's all we need. As long as rational people could think that, we win automatically. And that's why we win on the face of the complaint. I would like to go to that point as well. We've never contended that we have to go further than the face of the complaint. Many cases warn against getting too deeply entangled in the merits of a case to determine the substantiality point. And we do not recommend going past the face of the complaint, which is all we need anyway. And that makes it a much simpler test.
Is every equal protection claim then destined to be insubstantial because on the face of the complaint, a rational basis could be conceived to support it?
An excellent question, Your Honor. Let me propose a hypothetical. How about a regulation that said that only people may be admitted to Bachelor Gulch Metropolitan District who are not on public assistance? It's private property. I can think of no rational basis for making that distinction.
Now, you can imagine a group of wealthy landowners saying, we would like to exclude lower socioeconomic classes. But that would not be rational. And I cannot think of any way that you could come up with a rational basis. So, no. And there are many other, I could give many other examples. Am I truly out of time?
You truly are.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel today. Your arguments were excellent and helpful to us. We appreciate that. The matter is being submitted and expect to issue reports.